Hello and welcome to the Weekly News Roundup, a podcast of the Daily News. My name's Ann Brennan and I'm Editor-in-Chief of the Metro West Daily News and the Milford Daily News. Each Friday we discuss local stories that made the news. This week we'll talk about the role Massachusetts played in the slavery trades. Framingham hires a new CEO and Holliston mothers worry about toxins in the water. But now I'm joined by multimedia journalist Norm Miller. Good morning, Norm.
Hi, how are you?
A few months ago, you reported a story about an unidentified Stop and Shop employee who was arrested and charged with setting up a hidden camera, I think in a restroom in the store. The story grew intense, had a lot of interest among our readers, and there was an update this week.
Well, it was a Stop and Shop on Temple Street in Framingham. Just a short correction, he was not arrested at the time.
Okay.
But he was, you know, investigated, and they issued a summons, and he was arraigned this week on Tuesday in Framingham District Court. John Lola of Holliston. Apparently, he's been a long-term employee. Another employee told one of my coworkers that he had worked there for decades. Basically, he was charged with sneaking into an employee bathroom. It was a unisexual bathroom on the second floor of the Stop and Shop. And he went into one of the stalls and he installed a spy camera underneath a fake electrical outlet. So it looked like, you know, someone could plug in something, but it was really just hiding a camera. And luckily, one of the women who was in the bathroom was like, "That's a really weird place to have an outlet because you don't see one on the wall of a toilet stall." And she just touched it and it fell, and there's the camera just right there, pointed right at the level that you don't want the camera pointed at in the bathroom.
Do you know how long the camera, or do the police know how long the camera had been in place?
That camera looked like it was in place maybe for 24 hours or so. From the police report, it doesn't indicate if they know if there was previous cameras or if that was the first attempt. They actually caught him. They were able to go back through video and see that he went into the bathroom at the same time as what the first video was, which was a close-up of the suspect's face, like installing the camera, because he had to turn it on before he hit it with the fake electrical outlet. So they got a shot of his face, and they were able to match it with the same time as someone going into the bathroom on a security camera as being there. So that's how they were able to identify him as the suspect in this case.
And that's a store surveillance camera.
Store security camera, yeah.
Okay. So what are the next steps now? What's going to happen?
Well, right now, he got released without bail the other day. He was a summons arraignment. He appeared on his own, so that's normal. He faces 8 or 9 counts. I'm not 100% sure of photographing a person in a state of nudity without their knowledge. Next up will be a pretrial conference in April. And I'm guessing after that point, he'll just get into compliance and election, if they're going to file any motions. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of discovery because there was 30-something videos on the disc recovered from the camera. The defense lawyer is going to probably want to talk to all 30 victims because they're able to identify everyone on those videos. So that's probably going to be a little while, I guess.
Is there any evidence that that was a feed to another camera, or was he putting it there and take the video and the video is being stored on the camera and you'd have to remove it in order to see what the camera captured?
From the police report, it looks like it was captured on the camera itself because it had a disc. That's how they were able to look at what was captured. It had 30 something approximately 1 minute length videos on the camera, on the disc that was on the camera.
Well, thanks, Norm. You're also known as the Beer Nut, your famous weekly column, so I just have to ask you, what's happening on the beer front this week?
Oh, this is a very big week. As everyone knows, this is International Women's Month in the country, and every year around this time, the Pink Boots Society gets together. It's a national organization for women that promote education and scholarship for female brewers. Today and throughout this whole week, there's been Pink Boots Big Brew Day. Basically, breweries get together, all the female employees, and sometimes breweries combine, get together and brew a special beer just to female employees. They'll release it later, raises money for the Pink Boots Society. I know and one of the female employees at Jack's Abbey won a scholarship last year, after the Pink Boots Big Brew Day. She went to Germany for a few weeks. She actually works in the lab at Jack's Abbey. One of the former employees is the head of the Pink Boots Society in Boston. She actually works with Notch Brewing in Salem. They had their Big Brew Day yesterday. It's a good time for all. Springdale Brewing, which is the offshoot of Jack's Abbey, is really growing really quickly. They just expanded to distribution to Philadelphia this week. So they're doing really well. And Walden Woods Brewing in Marlboro is set to open in a couple weeks. They're going to be the first brewery in Marlboro probably for about 15, 20 years since Sherwood Forest opened. They brewed temporarily in Marlboro before they moved out. So Walden Woods, their tap room will be open in downtown in about a week or two. I'm going to be meeting with the brewer this week, and I'll have a story next week about what people should expect about the new beers and hours and everything like that you'd ever want to know about Walden Woods.
So not being a connoisseur of beer myself, is there a difference between what kind of beer women like to drink versus men, or is it just...
No, there used to be a stereotype that women like the lighter, fruitier beers, but it's really not. I mean, I have a really good friend I used to go out with a lot, and I'd be the one ordering the lighter beer. She'd be ordering the big, heavy stouts or the Imperial IPAs. It's really not. I think that's a kind of an antiquated thing that women like lighter beers and men like heavier beers. If you go to most beer festivals, there's really no difference between what the women and men drink.
Well, thanks, Norm.
No problem.
I'm joined on the phone by multimedia journalists Christopher Gavin and Scott Cozzoleo from our Milford Daily News office. Hello, Scott and Christopher.
Hey, how are you?
Scott, you covered a story this week about the history of Massachusetts and the slavery and abolition. It was a pretty impressive effort there. I'm wondering what led you to write these stories.
Well, it started with a story about a Revolutionary War veteran in Franklin who was a slave that I wrote back in November around Veterans Day. And his name was omitted from the town's memorial, but Susan Elliott from Dean College was able to uncover his story using old ledgers and other documents. So it kind of sparked my interest in what slavery was like in the Milford and Metro West areas.
And what did you find out in your reporting?
Yeah, so my biggest takeaway was that I kind of felt misguided growing up and learning about slavery. The abolitionist movement is so emphasized here. Well, it seems that the equally important history of slavery is kind of left on the back burner. Obviously, it wasn't as harsh in the North as it was in Southern tobacco plantations or in Caribbean sugar plantations, but they were still owned by another person. They did mostly domestic work, cleaning, cooking, tending the grounds. In some cases, when the Revolutionary War broke out, slaves would actually take the place of their masters in battle in return for gaining their freedom if they came out alive.
Yeah, as I understand it, you would get like a bonus for joining the Patriot Army, and the slave owners would take the money and let the slave go to war. We're talking about Africans. And at this point, there were some Native Americans as well who were put into slavery. And you're saying that, I guess, in the plantations, there were plantations that had, you know, upwards of 50 or more slaves, whereas here in New England, we're talking one or two, usually among people who had the wherewithal to support a slave or purchase a slave.
Right. So it wasn't nearly as common over here, but you know, there are a lot of stories, some of them like veterans that are forgotten, like Charles Payne, the first gentleman I mentioned from Franklin. And with some of them ended up in newspaper articles for far worse reasons. Like I mentioned, they work mostly domestic positions, but a lot of the time hand in hand with the family if they're wealthy enough to own a slave. But like I mentioned in one of my profiles, a slave named Jeffrey, he ended up actually murdering his master's wife and was later executed for it. But later, since he didn't have the money to, you know, fund his own burial, his bones were actually made into a wire skeleton for anatomical research.
You also interviewed some people in, I believe it was Medford, where there was quite a big estate at one point, and that was the area that family, the royal family, held the largest number of African slaves in the state around the time of the Revolutionary War. Am I correct in that?
Yes, they were kind of an exception to the New England slavery ideal here. They enslaved up to 50 African Americans, well, Africans, excuse me, and they ran this 500-acre gentleman's club, is what it was called. Basically, it was one of the only places in New England that actually had grass, like lawns. And they would do lavish parties, and this entire lifestyle was made because of slave labor.
And that's, they still have, it's a museum at this point.
Yeah, it's still open for touring. It's the largest standing slave quarters on the this side of the country.
There were some surprising things in your story. One was that Massachusetts was the first state to legalize enslavement of Africans, and then Rhode Island, merchants in Rhode Island around after the Revolutionary War controlled something like 60 to 90% of, or between 60 and 90% of the slave trade or the ships that were going over to Africa and getting by, you know, transporting slaves back to North America.
Yes, and in a lot of cases, the slave ships that were being used were actually built with slave labor. So it was kind of an extra punch.
And I guess there's also evidence that because of, like, the slaves, what slaves produced helped the economies of the colonies, but for example, a lot of cotton that was harvested by slaves in the South was brought up north to help run all the mills, or not run the mills, but help create fabric that the mills and the mill owners then sold. So it seems like there was not everybody was touched by slavery in ways that we don't often think about.
Every single family was touched by the institution of slavery. There, It ran the economy. Once slavery was abolished, the economy had to have basically an entire overhaul to figure out how these things would get done without slave labor.
So while Massachusetts was the first to legalize the slavery of Africans, they were people here in Massachusetts then a few, you know, decades later helped lead the abolitionist movement.
Yeah, they did. That's the history that most of us hear in school. We hear a lot about that. There's a place in Framingham that was formerly called Harmony Grove near the side of Farm Pond there. And they, every year on 4th of July, abolitionists from all around Massachusetts and some closer surrounding states or colonies at the time would gather and have speeches and rallies of anti-slavery. So it was very strong around here, including some very famous warriors and generals that came from the Framingham area as well.
Including Harmony Grove, which is in Framingham, and it was a meeting area for the abolitionist movement for many years?
Right, right.
Well, you also had a story this week about the Franklin police setting up an internet exchange zone. Mm-hmm. What's that all about?
So basically, with all of the fraud surrounding sites like Craigslist or Letgo or some exchanges that are done via Facebook, Franklin police took it upon themselves by the model of some surrounding towns to install a sign on one of their first parking spots in their public lot. There's a 24-hour surveillance camera trained on the location, and it's about 20 yards from the front door in case anything does go wrong. The purpose is basically to deter criminals from scamming people who use these sites. And
has there been a lot? Did the police say if there's been a lot of crime regarding people who are showing up thinking they're going to sell their rug or whatever to somebody, and the people steal the rug or something like that?
Yeah, Yeah, so I spoke with Sergeant Brian Johnson with the Franklin Police, and he said that unfortunately scams do happen every day, but hopefully this will do something to at least deter this type of scam. In a lot of cases, he said people are uncomfortable meeting at their houses, or in other cases, they're meeting in public parking lots, and that can look a little sketchy to some outsiders. And he told me that police have definitely rolled up on a lot of those trades.
Okay, well, Scott, thank you for joining us. We're now joined by Christopher Gavin. Good morning, Chris.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Good. So this week, the Milford residents went to the polls to vote on whether to allow pot businesses to operate in town. This was the second election in a few months. What did the voters say?
Well, Tuesday's vote was... you're correct. A second referendum for a town. Basically, the outcome is that 73.1% of voters backed a bylaw passed at town meeting in October to ban recreational marijuana businesses. That includes retail shops, cultivation and testing facilities from entering Milford, except for two. One that currently tests marijuana and one that currently grows marijuana. Those businesses will be allowed to move from the medical operations they have into the recreational business as the year goes on and we see the law take effect in Massachusetts.
So they'll be allowed to do both medical and recreational, or are they going to switch to recreational?
From what I hear so far, it would be them doing both.
So going forward, there's going to be no other... marijuana business allowed in town, and this must make these businesses pretty happy. There won't be any competition, right?
Correct. I mean, that was the criticism of some folks in town urging fellow residents to vote against this proposition. They felt that it would give these businesses an unfair monopoly, but in the business's defense, I spoke to one of the owners about a week or two ago, Christopher Hudala, who is the founder and chief scientific officer at ProVerde Laboratories, the testing facility I mentioned. He said, you know, this certainly isn't the case that they were backing this proposal because it is just a way to get any sort of marijuana industry going in town. And I was told by the other owner that, you know, last fall, they had posed the ban outright. He said, you know, their support of that measure certainly doesn't indicate that, you know, that they were out to just form a monopoly from the very beginning.
Okay. Well, there were a couple of other towns in the Milford area that had marijuana votes this week. Can you tell us a little bit about those elections?
Yeah, so both Medway and Bellingham, which border Milford, they both had votes, and they both prohibited recreational pot sales. Essentially not having any recreational marijuana businesses in those towns either.
Okay. It's still a hot topic, marijuana, across the state. So you write a weekly political notebook column that appears in Sunday's paper. What are some of the highlights for what's going on in the political scene this week?
Well, in the most recent column, I touched on a few things. I try to do a mix of statewide stuff and local stuff. I know in my most recent column, Brian Murray, a state representative from Milford, he represents the 10th Worcester District, will run for re-election. He's currently in his freshman term, but he'll be seeking the nomination again later this fall. And on a statewide scale, we saw a lot of lawmakers from Governor Baker to both of the senators, Ed Markey and Senator Warren, as well as several congresspeople across the state, all getting behind a letter basically telling the federal government, don't drill for oil off of the shore of Massachusetts. Folks might have heard about this here and there over the last year, the what they call, and this is quite an educational lesson for me, but what is called the Outer Continental Shelf and the Northern Atlantic Ocean, which right off the border of Massachusetts, is an area that's been protected since the 1980s, hasn't been allowed or hasn't been up for, I should say, for leasing to oil companies for drilling. The Trump administration has kind of put it on somewhat of a proposal to make it available for drilling between 2019 and 2024. And basically these lawmakers got together, not the first time, but once again wrote a letter saying, please don't do this. They cited that in 2015 alone, the marine economy brought in $17.336 billion to the state from tourism, recreation, other industries, the fishing industry. Basically they're like, hey, there's a lot of natural resources here, some fragile ecosystems that benefit our state in more ways than one. And they're hoping that the federal government hears them and takes them up on that request.
I know since this this proposal was put forward by Secretary Zinke that in Florida, the Governor Scott was able to persuade them to not drill off of Florida. I think Alaska as well, but those are both, we'll see what happens here. Thank you, Chris, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're now joined in studio by Allison Bosma. Hello, Allison.
Hi, Ann.
You reported a story about a group of women in Holliston who noticed something wrong with the water in their town, and that might be connected to some birth defects. What can you tell us about this?
Well, it wasn't really about the water initially. This was a group of moms who realized that there were a lot of health problems, unusual health problems, especially in kids, and they wondered if there was anything in the environment that was causing it. So they started to do some of their own research. They reached out to their local and state officials, didn't really get anywhere. At one point, one of the moms coordinated sort of a neighborhood-wide fundraising campaign to test the water on her area, and it came back really high for radiologicals, I think it was. Sorry about that. And then the town had to do their own testing. It's very complicated, but what they're at right now, they did a study with Clark and Boston universities, and it looks like there's a few things with that one as well. There's concern that the water is vulnerable to some contaminated sites. The DPW right now says that that's not such a problem because the filtering systems in town are effective, but there's some worry that that could be a problem. And then the very interesting thing to me about this story was manganese, which is not currently a highly regulated element in the Holliston water, but could be sort of the next thing that gets well regulated.
Because it looked like the levels were elevated.
Yeah, but it's important to note this is not just Holliston at all. Mm-hmm. That's what this study focused on because they needed something to focus on, and the moms that came to the researchers were from Holliston. But it is not at all just Holliston. It's a problem. Manganese specifically is a problem across all New England, and this other issue of contaminated sites is an issue nationwide.
Right, and when you say they're like the aquifer, I understand, which is their source of drinking water, is shallow, so that makes the water a little more susceptible to contaminants. But that it's town water that goes through a town process that removes it filters the bad things out of the water.
That's right.
Right. Okay. So, it took these women like 10 years to get somebody to study this, right?
Yeah. A lot of their kids are 9 or 10 years old, and the reason they got involved was because they noticed some developmental delays or some genetic issues. There were a lot of different things that they noticed in their kids when they were really young, and that's what got them onto this.
So some of them, like there were a couple of kids who were born with one kidney?
Yep, in the same neighborhood.
In the same neighborhood.
Yep. Right.
And it was that the one with the chromosomal issue?
Nope, that was a different neighborhood. There were, I think it was 5 kids in a relatively small area that had an issue with chromosome 18. There was a cluster study done by the state, but it was determined that there was enough differences among the kids that it didn't qualify for a cluster.
So what are the next steps on this? I know there was one meeting following your first story.
Yeah, the researchers came to town and talked to answered questions, really, from residents. But the next big step is really, it sounds like Holliston does need another treatment plant. The DPW director is asking for it's a little over $8 million to put in this new treatment plant. And that's supposed to clear, because there is a lot of brown water in Holliston. You ask people for photos of their brown water, and they respond immediately. They show you photos of their filters that are just chocolate, mm-hmm. From like just a few months of their water going through there. There's a chemical that the DPW gives out to clean your clothes, and if you accidentally wash them while this brown water was going through your laundry. So Holliston does need to take care of that, and this new $8 million treatment plant is supposed to do that.
And so they're looking for some kind of funding for this at this point? Is this just at the beginning stages?
I'm pretty sure it requires an override at town meeting, so this spring town meeting, so coming up soon.
Okay. Well, is there anything people can do in the meantime while they're waiting? Is there filters at home?
The moms that I talked to had water coolers in their home. They used... Poland Springs or something like that to make their coffee, make their ice cubes, obviously to drink with. So that's what they're doing.
Okay. So on a more lighter subject, you worked on a story about a church that's giving or gave away free gas over the weekend. What was that about?
Yeah, this was fun. So this is Connect Community Church in Ashland. They are opening a new location. I think this weekend is the grand opening of their second location, and that will be in Framingham. This is a church that's actually growing. A lot of churches in the area, and probably the nation, are sort of declining in population, and Connect Community Church is growing. They've got hundreds of people that go to services every weekend. So they gave away free gas, as they said it was a way to communicate, the message of God, and also I think probably a little bit of advertising for the new location.
And so what kind of denomination are they? Is it Baptist or?
I'm not sure. It's Christian, I'm not sure.
Okay. And finally, you had a story this week about changes in solar power arena in the state of Massachusetts.
So this one's also a little complicated. There's nothing extremely new, but there is a group that's asking legislators to try to do something about, my favorite word from this story was solar coaster. So the idea that the solar industry has its ups and extreme ups and extreme downs. And right now, this group is called Vote Solar. And what they say is limiting the industry are a couple of things. One is something that is going to change if the legislature doesn't stop it, I guess, which is Eversource is asking to put a third line on the bills of people who have solar panels on their roofs. It does raise the bill, but it also makes it extremely complicated to understand your bill and to understand how you can control the cost on your bill. So they're going to charge you for the highest use you had during the month. But according to Vote Solar, they don't have a way to tell you when that charge happened. So okay. You can't figure it out and try to control it.
And this third line is going to be about power that you use that came from solar panels, that these more commercial?
I'm not sure. It is really confusing, and that's part of the reason why Vote Solar doesn't want it to happen.
Okay.
Because it discourages people from getting solar panels if they know they have to deal with this extra piece on their bill.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that, if it's not stopped, will happen in 2019. And the other issue is they're hoping to raise the cap on net metering. Net metering, from how I understand it, is what you sort of get back when you have solar, when you put power onto the energy grid.
So if you generate more power than you're using, it goes back into the grid. And I believe that the utilities have to pay you for that.
Right. Yeah. It comes off your bill.
Okay. And so they're going to cap that as well?
It is capped. They're hoping to raise the cap by 5%. Volt Solar would like to get rid of, and you know, the whole industry mm-hmm. would love to just get rid of the cap. But they seem to be willing to compromise at a 5% raise, which they think will carry the industry through a few more years.
It's interesting, in Metro West, there's not a lot of wind power because there's not enough wind. Mm-hmm. But if everywhere you look, it seems there's solar power plants going up. I know, like over at Bowes Mountain in the Framingham Technology Park, they just put in a 1.8 megawatt mm-hmm. plant, or I guess group of solar panels, and you see them a lot in this area. So is it a kind of healthy out here, or are they talking about statewide is where the issues are?
The two companies that I spoke to in our area are suffering. They had to lay off a big part of their workforce. I think they hired them anticipating growth in the industry, and then they had to lay them off. So they're nervous about growing, really. I guess the problem is it limits expansion.
And there are the tariffs in place now that are making the solar panels a little more expensive for people to purchase.
Yep.
Okay, well, thank you, Allison.
You're welcome.
I'm joined by Jim Hattadine now, who is also, I'm very grateful for producing this episode. Thank you, Jim.
Happy to do the honors.
Well, in between those duties, you've been pretty busy this week covering a lot of news that's coming out of Framingham. First, this week, we have the city hired a new CEO, Thatcher Keyser III. What can you tell us about him?
So Mr. Keyser is coming in to be the new chief operating officer for the city, which is a very important position. It's kind of like being the second in command for the mayor. So doing a lot of work that the assistant town manager used to do, overseeing kind of the day-to-day operations of all of municipal government. So it's a really important role one of the major hires that the mayor has made to date. Thatcher Keyser was known to many people as the former mayor of Amesbury. So he was the mayor of Amesbury from 2006 to 2013. He lost a very close re-election campaign in 2013, I think by like 3 votes after a recount. So he moved on from that position and has been in a few different roles, but he was most recently at Mass Development, which is I think it's a quasi-public state agency that does a lot of financing and development work. And he was an executive for them working on the redevelopment of Fort Devens in Ayer and Shirley. So he seems like somebody. Oh, and he's also got a long military background. He retired as a lieutenant colonel from the Massachusetts Air National Guard and was in the U.S. Air Force for a number of years before that. So that's another facet of what he's done. So he's someone that seems to be very well regarded from the feedback that I've gotten from people in the city. He also seems very well known. The chairman of the school committee knew him before he was hired. The chairman of the city council has had a relationship with him in the past, and both had very good things to say about him. So I think there's been a lot of positive feedback to the mayor's decision to choose him for this role.
From a resume point of view, a former mayor who understands what being a mayor is all about and the pitfalls probably is probably a good attribute for a city that's just starting to develop its government at what it's 2 months old. And also the angle of redevelopment, which is one of the things that they're really hoping, or Yvonne Spicer and the city council are really hoping to revitalize that area of the city.
Yeah, it's a huge goal for the city. It's it was one of the, I would say, two or three major threads during the campaign is the need to bring more redevelopment to the city. So you could argue that this is somebody who is a very smart choice from that perspective, that he's been doing that kind of work for Mass Development for several years.
And it's somebody that everybody can agree on, because some of the previous hires have led to some contentious relationships, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, so the fundamental difference here is this is a job that was specifically envisioned by the Charter Commission when they put together the new city charter. That there was a healthy debate around what this person would do, what their job title would be. whether or not they would have to be confirmed by the city council, and the Charter Commission decided, no, this should be a role that the mayor really has kind of sole discretion to pick the person that she wants to have in the job. So I have not heard a bad word yet about Thatcher Keezer, so he's going to be on the job starting April 2nd.
Well, another development or part of the discussion in town is what to do about the Fuller School. They want to either replace it, renovate it. What's new now on that front?
The school building committee that has been working on this issue since the beginning of 2016 has kind of winnowed the list of options down to four, maybe five things that they're considering. And essentially, it seems like they're moving in the direction of building a new, smaller school in the area where the Fuller School is now on Flag Drive. And they are getting close, probably within the next 3 or 4 weeks, to choosing the design that is their preferred design to really hash out and to send that to the Massachusetts School Building Authority, which will give the city a tremendous amount of money for this project if they meet all the requirements. So we're getting very close to, you know, a pretty pivotal moment for the city to say, this is how we're going to do it. This is the design we like. This is how we're going to house the children while the building is being done. If there is a new building built, one of the advantages is you don't need to bring in temporary classrooms. You can actually have the middle school students at Fuller stay in the Fuller Middle School while the new building is constructed. So it'll save the city, you know, maybe like $6 million in terms of not having to get the swing space, and will theoretically be less disruptive. So that seems like the direction they're moving toward, but we're going to see that decision made. And most recently this week, at their meeting on Monday night, there was some discussion about what they want to do for a gymnasium in terms of how big it should be. But also they talked about the need to have some certainty around the membership of the school building committee, because with the transition from town to city, hypothetically, the mayor could put somebody else onto the building committee if she chooses to. The school committee may also have the opportunity to do something like that. But the members of that group want to really have some certainty that they're all going to be in place to kind of finish this process going forward. So they took a vote to kind of formally ask the mayor to, you know, say one way or the other if she's planning to put somebody else on or swap out somebody who's already serving on that group. And it doesn't look necessarily like she is really looking to shake things up, but they just kind of want to get a firmer sense of where things stand.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how that goes. I mean, schools are so expensive, and as you can see, Natick, their middle school's $110 million, so see how that goes. The other thing that came up, and this was another big campaign issue I remember during the whether to become a city, was the signed bylaw. I guess the city's going to take a look at the bylaw and see if it can be revised. What were some of the issues around that?
I think different businesses have different concerns about the kind of hoops that they have to jump through to get a sign permitted and to make sure that it complies with all the regulations of the signed bylaw. I should say the kind of discontent with the sign bylaw is, a long-running issue in Framingham, to the point where people have done like comedic skits about, you know, being upset about the sign bylaw over the years. So there have been various steps to revise it along the way, and I think it's, some people are maybe happy with where it is now, but I think a lot of businesses have voiced displeasure with it. And we would hear anecdotes during the campaign from people running for city council, running for mayor, talking about how cumbersome it is. So on Tuesday night, Michael Cannon, who's the district councilor from District 4, got approval from the council to use his economic development subcommittee that he chairs to kind of start studying this issue and coming up with some recommendations for things that might need to change in terms of, you know, maybe you could have a different set of regulations for the central business district than from other parts of town. I think they are somewhat different already, but maybe, you know, give people a little more leeway if you're right in downtown and you have, you know, a restaurant or something like that that you want to open up, to do a more creative sign, a bigger sign, something that doesn't fall squarely within the boundaries of the sign bylaw now. And I guess it can be a huge pain if the building commissioner comes by and tells you your sign is non-compliant, you could face fines. And if you want to get permission from the city to keep that sign in place, you probably have to pay to get a lawyer. You're going to wind up going before the ZBA or the planning board to get permission for it. And it's a real pain in the butt. So that's where things are headed now.
In my career, I've covered a lot of town government, and signs are one of the biggest issues. You know, a lot of people, it's either, it's got to be uniform, it's got to be a certain size, or, and so it's always an issue.
Yeah, there's always, you know, different perspectives on it in different communities. Some places really, you know, tightly regulated it to, you know, try to have this common sense of what their public spaces look like. Other places, not so much, more hands off. And you see that in different neighborhoods in Boston and in Wellesley and, you know, all these other places. Mm-hmm. So it's an ongoing issue in a lot of communities.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what they come up with.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll have more coverage to come.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Jim, and thank you again for producing this episode. You can find the links to stories that we spoke about with the show notes, and be sure to listen to the Daily News podcast on Monday with host Caitlin Kelleher. And thanks again for listening. I hope you'll join us again next week.